Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Authors Access, where authors get published and published authors get successful. I'm Tyler Tischler, Associate Editor for Reader Views.
And I'm Victor Volkman with Loving Healing Press in Ann Arbor, Michigan. It's May 7th, 2009, and welcome to episode number 86 in our series. Tonight's topic is What Every Publisher Must Know About Accounting, and our special guest is Edna Washington. We'll have a conversation about the good, the bad, and the ugly of accounting. You can learn more about our guest on the Authors Access website, which is authorsaccess.com. We'd love to hear your questions and comments about tonight's show. Please send them to info@authorsaccess.com. Now tonight, our guest is Edna Washington, who is a workshop presenter and owner of Washington Consultants, LLC. She has over 15 years of accounting and computer experience, and she attended the University of Missouri at St. Louis. Washington Consultants provides accounting and computer services to small businesses. They also offer computer skills training for youth and adults. Now, Ms. Washington also volunteers with youth organizations to help young people succeed in life. She believes in giving back to her community. She believes that our youth just need to be encouraged and shown that there's a world out there to be conquered. Well, welcome, Edna.
Hi.
Hi, Edna. Wow, what a great introduction. And it's great that you're encouraging youth. I wish we could get more young people interested in publishing especially. So we're going to get started with my first question is about what to do when you first start to go into business for yourself, specifically for authors. Say that you're an author and you're about to publish your first book. We'll say that you're self-publishing the first book, so you're basically doing everything by yourself. What are some of the first steps that you have to go through, such as do you need to register as a business? Do you need to worry about getting a special kind of federal employee identification number? Can your Social Security number work? And what about like setting up a special bank account? Do you need to do that, or can you just use your personal checking account? So can you just kind of give us the basics of those kind of starting out points when you first get started?
Well, there's a lot to do in first starting out, and generally what I suggest to authors, publishers, and just really business owners in general when they're first starting out is you should be listed as a business, like have a business name and have a business registered. What's really good now by way of registering a business, especially in the state of Michigan, it's really easy to do on state of Michigan's website. So what I suggest is most likely it's easier to register a business. Specifically, now I suggest as a LLC, that's one of a limited liability corporation for a publisher or a self-published author to set up. And generally with that, I suggest having it as a two-member LLC as opposed to a single member. And you would still only, if you were listed as a single member, you would still use your Social Security number when it's tax time, but otherwise you would need to get a tax ID number. So there's a lot involved in getting started, setting up the company, getting a tax ID number if you're going to actually start the business as a limited liability corporation. After that, yes, a business account would be needed. It's fairly much recommended to keep any business finances and personal finances separated. The IRS really doesn't look favorably upon what would be considered basically commingling your funds. You want to have a clear pathway, a clear way of identifying that money's expensed and or money's received or specifically related to a business entity. So there's a lot that the IRS requires, and so as an accountant, I try to keep up with all those requirements so that I can pass that information along to authors, publishers, and the like.
Edna, can you explain a little bit? You're talking about an LLC. Can you explain? I guess I'm a little bit surprised when you say that. Why would if you were a author just going to publish your own book, why would you want to be an LLC rather than say a sole proprietorship?
With a sole proprietorship, your business income and any other income that you would have, say for example, I know sometimes starting out, people aren't able to have their income, the only income that they have for themselves through their business. Most times people are a publisher and then have a regular job, let's say, I don't want, for lack of a way to put it,
right,
a W-2 income job, such that, you know, you're able to have income while starting out in the publishing. So if you're just a sole proprietor, then there's no separation between yourself as an individual and your business. And the reason I suggest an LLC, and that's really for security purposes, if you will, well, for two reasons. I like to say for the security of it, so that your personal income would not be able to be attached if there were lawsuits or anything of that nature from business operations. Then your personal, if your business was a sole proprietorship, then it's all together. Both your personal and your business would be one, and they wouldn't be a separate entity. So it's good to have a business as a separate entity. For example, my company, Washington Consultants, LLC, is not the same entity as Edna Washington. So if your business is a sole proprietorship, then your business name only appears on the form that's attached to your regular 1040 when it comes to tax time. So, again, it's for the security of the business being separated from you as an individual, as well as the tax benefit from the standpoint of not being taxed twice on the income that you receive from your business. For example, with the LLC, especially if it's a two-member LLC, and let's say you have 51 and 49% ownership, respectively, for those two members, the member that has the 51% would only be taxed as it relates to 51% of any profit that the business owns, as opposed to being responsible for paying taxes on all of the profit on the business if you were a single or sole proprietor. So there's really different benefits depending on the way a business is structured. If there's not a lot of activity or not a lot of activity, I guess, expected starting out, it would probably be okay to start as a sole proprietorship. But again, you forfeit those benefits of being a separate entity.
Okay. Well, that makes sense to me. Like myself, I started out just going to publish a book, not really knowing where it was going to go from there. And over time, it's now come to the point where I am self-employed, and I not only am an author and have published books, but now I run my own business as an editor and a proofreader and a book reviewer. And so as time goes by, you have growing pains and you learn these things. But if somebody was just starting out, what would you recommend to them? Do you recommend that in order to figure out how to structure things, would you recommend that they go and they find an accountant, or they go talk to someone somewhere like at H&R Block, or they take a course, or they read some books about structuring a business? What would be your best advice there?
Well, of course I'd say yes, talk to an accountant. But also, the IRS has really good information regarding structuring your business. I like to view the IRS as my friend, and I know that's unthought of, but I say that because of the information that they do provide. And I do believe generally overall that in terms of business growth and development, that the IRS really want business to understand what is required of them. But I would say yes to work with an accountant. Generally, an accountant would be able to share with you, if even after reviewing the information. And what I do with clients or prospective clients is point them in the direction of IRS information, and then when more information in terms of really understanding what they've consumed by way of the information, when they need a further explanation, then that's where I would be able to help them. And so with that, it's understanding from an accountant standpoint what the IRS rules are, what's required of a business, and so on, sharing that information, then I help a client to know what their next steps are, what they need to do to be in compliance with IRS rules and regulations. There's a lot of A lot of information sometimes. It can be a little overwhelming, but they, as it relates to the when the taxes are due and different tax calendars, you know, the IRS provides that information, and then generally an accountant would be able to really help a business narrow down that time frame. For example, if it was a business that had employees, then an accountant would help in with payroll issues and knowing when to make payments as related to what has been taken out of employees' pay and things of that nature. So, yes, I would say work with an accountant, but also leave the line of communication open with the IRS, too, and don't be afraid to communicate with them as well.
Great. This kind of segues into my next question, which is record keeping. I suppose everyone starts out with a shoebox of receipts, but where do you go from there? Is it reasonable to track everything on Excel spreadsheets, or do I have to get a full-blown, you know, bookkeeping data entry system like QuickBooks?
That generally depends on the business. I love QuickBooks. I'm not paid by QuickBooks or Intuit. Let me say that before. I really love their product, though. And I say that because a business owner doesn't really have to have an accounting background, per se, in order to use the software. It's a really user-friendly, it comes with a lot of tools for really understanding how the software works. But I do know a lot of business owners that still use the Excel spreadsheets. And generally, if you have a Excel system that you can work with that can help you produce a financial statement and you're comfortable with that starting out, then I would say that's probably okay starting out. But I wouldn't want to keep that as the mainstay of my business, that using the Excel can get a little cumbersome. But a software package like QuickBooks, just like you would write a check from your personal checkbook, you can record transactions in QuickBooks, like writing a check. They have a window that looks like your actual checkbook where you can record transactions. And so it's really easy to set up. I would recommend having an accountant set up the software and then perhaps spend some time in actually being trained on how to use it. And generally, I say, and using a software like that, I've trained individuals on up to a 3 or 4 hour training session, and then they're able to go on their own with using that software. And so I would say, yes, use something like QuickBooks, but there are other software that do the similar thing. So being able to provide financial statements, software like Microsoft Money, Mind Your Own Business software, other accounting software packages. So those are helpful in keeping records, which is really important.
Great. What are some of the common things that self-published authors will forget to track in their record-keeping systems?
You know, generally what I found is that often what's forgotten is, I know there's a lot of, especially in the beginning stages, there are those meetings that you're going to for with other publishers or your clients or those that you're working with on putting the book together. And oftentimes those miles, travel miles for anything that's related to that, are often overlooked. And in keeping with that, that's really helpful as a deduction for tax time, your business miles. And it doesn't have to be anything that's elaborate in keeping up with that. I mean, it could be something as simple as a notebook that on days that you're taking care of matters regarding your book and you're doing a lot of running around, just keeping up with where you're going and the mileage on your car, what it was when you started and what it was when you got to your ending point. Another thing I think that's often overlooked is I know a lot of times a lot of research goes into putting a book together, and so maybe there are other books perhaps that you're purchasing to as a research item for a book that you're about to put together. And so sometimes those expenses are often overlooked as well.
Yeah, that's definitely some good places to consciously remember what you're doing. Now, oftentimes when an author goes to self-publish, they'll maybe buy between 2,000 and 5,000 books, which is a lot, and I mean that could amount to say $10,000. And I know it's not exactly right to expense that. So, how does inventory get amortized in modern accounting?
It's not to make it too complicated. Normally, you can do one of two things with those expenses, depending on the amount of the expense and the time in which you expect to sell that book that you have these expenses for. You can either expense a portion of it over a given period of time, for example, over 1 to 2 year period if you're talking about that large amount of expense, or you can capitalize it and take it all in the first year. Well, and by that I mean you can list that, you can take the full benefit of having paid for that purchase of all of those books when it's probably not likely that it's within the first year that you're going to sell all of those books. So, and the publisher themselves probably wouldn't have to be concerned with all of the particulars about how the amortization is actually calculated. Your accountant would be able to calculate that, and generally that's pretty much a startup cost, which you're able to take, you know, within the first year or so. So it is something that you would need to let your accountant know, hey, I've purchased, you know, made this run of all these books, and this was the amount that it cost, and the calculation for how that'll actually be made as a deduction when it comes to your tax time, as well as recording it for accounting purposes will be taken into account at that time. But that's a good question, because a lot of times that's really not thought about. You have all this book and this large expense, but, you know, now what is basically the question. But your accountant will be able to help you in properly accounting for that.
Yeah, and that's a good segue into my next question. I know lots of authors are concerned about how the IRS is going to classify them, depending on if they actually make a profit or not, if they're going to be allowed to retain a status as a business, or if they're going to be just considered as a hobby if they're not selling enough books. So how soon do you actually have to start to make a profit when you start out as an author?
You guys have great questions. These are really good questions that really, most of the time, you're right, people really don't, you know how to go about. Well, generally what they say is that you have 3 years in order to make a profit. But the problem doesn't, after three, if you haven't made a profit in 3 years, then they'll look at whether or not you're actually a business or not, or if this is just a hobby. But the question comes into if you're actively involved in trying to create a profit, then that's not a problem. If it's such that, you know, you're kind of like, how can I say it, on again, off again, you're actively involved in activity, and then there's a stretch of period when there's no activity, whether there's any expenses for the business or income at all, then it's likely that it'll be said that you're more than likely a hobby and not a business, because you will want to show that there is continued activity by way of trying to generate a profit. Sometimes, even though they say it's 3 years, sometimes for businesses, depending on the type of business, and especially in this economy, it may take 4 years, for example. But it's still important during that time to keep good records of everything that's being spent in trying to generate income. So even though the IRS uses that 3 years as a threshold, it's not unusual for afford to take longer for a business to generate income, as long as you have business records to show that you are actually trying to generate income. Then there's no problem from the IRS standpoint.
Okay, so the most important thing I'm hearing is keep very good records, and you know, this is an answer to all of your questions here.
And we'd like to interrupt our broadcast for just a moment to announce our first collaborative book, Authors Access, 30 Success Secrets for Authors and Publishers, edited by Irene Watson, Tyler Tischler, and me, Victor Volkman. This book contains the distilled wisdom of more than 24 guests to our show in an easy-to-read, easy-to-understand reference, organized into chapters that reflect the life cycle of your books. Authors Access, 30 Success Secrets for Authors and Publishers, lets you learn about the best practices and avoid pitfalls in writing, editing, cover design, marketing, book reviews, online presence, genre and children's books, and many other key topics. As a special thank you to everyone, we'll include a free Best of Authors Access CD-ROM, jam-packed with MP3 files from all our shows. And for more information about the book, just go to our homepage, www.authorsaccess.com, and click on Success Secrets in the upper left corner. And now we return you back to our show.
The one thing that I often wonder about, and I know I've heard other people say that, like, they own their own business and then they pay themselves. You know, either they're paying themselves an hourly wage, or they're paying themselves paying themselves royalties. Could you explain how a person would go about and do that, or figure out, you know, what are you allowed to pay yourself, or do you even need to be concerned about doing something like that?
Two things with that. Number one is there are, I guess you would call, benchmarks for, depending on the type of business or, you know, entity that the IRS says what that kind of business could generate an income, and what, for example, a publisher, the owner of a publishing company would be expected to make based on the size of the business. A small business, a small publishing company, a company just starting out that you don't have a lot of income, then it's probably just expected that you're going to take you're paying yourself, but not necessarily a salary, because your business isn't generating enough income to pay what would be considered a salary. So then the way that's handled is you would write yourself, if you would still write yourself a check, but consider it an owner's draw. And by that, you mean you wouldn't be expensing it, for example, like a salary expense, but you would write yourself a check. It's an equity line item in your balance sheet, but it just really says you're paying yourself. You're not really generating a salary per se, but from the income that's coming in from your business, you still have, your own personal item needs that need to be taken care of. I mean, perhaps some of your income from your business, because it is small and just starting out, you still have your household expenses that have to be accounted for or taken care of. So really, you would write yourself a check for whatever those needs are, and your accountant would consider that an owner's draw, and it would be accounted for appropriately. As the business grows though, and you're able actually to take a salary, then you would pay yourself what is expected for your business position. So a lot of times the way that's gauged is there are these ways to calculate what your salary should be. And so I know there's a website like account temps, like some of the temporary agencies shows calculators for what a salary should be for any type of job, at all. And so one would be able to gauge what they would be worth in the actual job market. And so that's how you would determine, as your business grows, what your salary should be as a business owner.
Okay, great. I'll have to go and look at some of those websites then and find that out. My next question here for you is, I'm wondering about people having to pay out their either sales taxes to the state or making like quarterly tax payments to the state and to the government. And at what point does a business, at what point do you know that you're making enough money that you need to be concerned about making quarterly payments, or and how do you figure out like how much you should set aside so that you have what you need to make those payments for your taxes?
Well, that's basically what you're asking about there, is self-employment taxes. And if the business is actually making a profit, then the self-employment taxes would be based on that. That would be just the same as, for example, with your W-2 income, the IRS has with the W-2 income, the Social Security and Medicare income that is associated with that is pretty much similar to what the self-employment taxes would be for a self-employed person. So the IRS already has a way of helping you to calculate what your self-employment taxes should be so upon calculating that, then you would send that in. But again, a lot of times business owners with that early on, especially if the business is a sole proprietorship, you're really going to calculate any self-employment tax, especially if you already have other income in along with when you do your taxes. So that's not a big deal in the beginning. So I wouldn't be so concerned with it. But as you go along then, and the business grows, and by that time you would actually need an accountant that would be able to help you in calculating it. But so there's a certain percentage based on how much of profit there is in a business. It's really hard to explain without getting really into too much detail to kind of like really overwhelm people. But the important thing to note is that there are guidelines as it relates to that. So what your question basically related to was the self-employment tax.
Right. Yeah, that's a great summary for that. Let's talk about the home office expense. What is that? And I've heard that there's times that the IRS looks on it with as kind of a good or bad thing.
The thing with that is to make sure that you have really good, again, it's really important, and I can't overstress the point of how important it is really to have good record keeping. And so as it relates to that home office expense, what that means is generally, and I'm sure starting out many businesses are initially home-based, and so as a result, you're not penalized for not being out there in the world, so to speak, with a big lavish office, but you're still able to capture some of the expenses that would be associated with having your own office. And so how it works in a nutshell is, if, for example, you're using a spare bedroom in your home, that for numbers' sake, and to make it a little more simplified, and say that's 25% of the total space in your home. Well, the good thing about knowing that it's whatever percentage it is, and again, we'll just use that as an example, then every expense that's in your home that's also business related. For example, if you pay your mortgage and your office is 25% of the total space of your home, and based on whatever your mortgage is, then you would be able to take 25% of that expense and use that as a business expense. So, for example, if your mortgage was $1,000, then 25% of that, or $250, you would be able to use as your monthly expense for rent. Same thing with your home phone, unless you had a different phone line that was also business. That was business related. Then if you had a business line that was separate from your regular phone, then you would be able to use that the total amount of that business phone line for a business expense. But I don't really think, I mean, the IRS set these regulations up, and so I don't think it's looked upon as a bad thing at all. And today so many businesses are home-based, and so it's not unusual. The only thing is that you would want to make sure that that you stay in line in terms of what the percentages. Again, in the example that I used, if the room that you're using is 25%, it has to be an area that is used solely and exclusively for, let's say, your administrative task of billing and perhaps making your phone calls and the nuts and bolts of your business, as long as it's in line with that percentage and everything stays in line with that same percentage, that shouldn't be a problem. But again, it's really important to make sure that everything is documented.
Okay, well, that doesn't sound so scary then.
No, well, it shouldn't. It shouldn't. I don't think it really should be looked at as something that should be scary. You know, like I said, the important thing is the record is making sure everything is documented. But I say, if the IRS allows you this deduction, then certainly they can't penalize you for taking it.
Absolutely.
Right.
All right, let's talk a little bit about 1099s. What is a 1099, and when should I expect to have to give someone a 1099, and when should I expect to receive one?
Well, the 1099 is used basically for a business owner in lieu of a W-2. So now you're a business owner, and your client company's or, you know, when you actually provide service or that, the companies that pay you provide you with the 1099. With the 1099, every couple years or so, the IRS changes the regulation in terms of how much, at what point you can expect to receive one. For the filing for 2008, I believe the limit was $600. So unless, for example, unless I were paid at least $600 from any particular client, then I wouldn't expect to receive a 1099 from them. If I received at least $600 or more, then they would be expected to supply me with a 1099. Generally, what I find in that area, sometimes business owners will record their income at a certain amount. However, they'll have 1099s that may amount to more than what their recorded income is. And generally how that would be handled by a tax preparer or accountant is the total that's shown on, like say you have several, four or five 1099s, and the totals from all of those would have to be shown as your income, even though what's on your books may be less. And the reason for that is the dollar amounts that are on the 1099 are what has been reported to the IRS. And so you would want to record what's been reported to the IRS so as you would not be penalized for underreporting your income.
Great. Okay, let's talk about if I'm going out there to look for an accounting consultant, what types of things should I be looking for? Should I find out if they have clients in my line of business, or should I get a personal recommendation for someone, or how would I go about starting to narrow down the field?
Well, those two things that you mentioned are great starting points. Most time, people are comfortable with receiving, you know, referring someone to you. So if you know of others that have used an accountant that they're happy with, then, you know, you would want to, you know, get that recommendation of who it is. The other thing that you mentioned is it is important to know if your accountant has experience in the industry or field that you're in. you know, so that they are aware of the particular issues that face that type of business. Really important thing is to really to understand how the accountant charges for their services. And sometimes accountants may charge by the project or on a monthly basis or on an hourly basis. And so it's real important to be real clear as to, you know, exactly how that billing process will take place, so that down the line there are no, you know, misunderstandings or anything. It's also real important, and I know for myself what I generally do is, and what most accountants is really able to tell you for any particular project, you know, that you're needing services for, basically that should be able to give you a range in terms of what the fees could be between this and that point. Now, if you're unable to kind of tie them down, so to speak, on what the fee would be, then that might be somewhat of a red flag that, you know, to let you know that down the line you may be surprised with billing. Now, what I do for myself is I'm able to clearly let a client know what my hourly rate is if the project is going to be based on an hourly rate, or, for example, if it's for training and we have a certain number of hours, then I may just do a project rate. And so an accountant should be able to be clear as to what their fees are. The other thing that I think it's important in when choosing an accountant is if that person is someone that would be able to, you know, to help you as your business grows. And by that I mean be able to make referrals to you of prospective clients, as well as other areas that you may need assistance in. Now, I know, like myself, as an accountant, I try to be all things to all people, but I'm not that. So it's good for accounts to have a good resource base of other people that they can refer their clients to. I'm an accountant, and so when it comes to insurance for your business, that's not my field. So I should be able to have a referral base of colleagues that I can refer to a client. So that way I think your accountant is able to add value to the services that they provide by being able to link you up with others that are able to help you as well.
I was going to ask you, Edna, if you could explain to us a little bit about what we have to do in terms of collecting sales tax, because I know when I started out I wasn't sure if every book I sold I had to collect sales tax on it, even if I was shipping it to California. And also, if you do other services, say, for example, that you do proofreading for somebody, do you have to charge sales tax on the services that you offer to somebody if they're in the same state as you?
Okay. Well, for services, there's generally not taxes, sales taxes associated with that. Now, the regulations as it relates to sales tax, if you're for selling the books, now there would be the sales tax associated with your sale of those. Like, for example, for an event in Michigan, now how that relates to if it's being sent out of state. For example, you use California. Now, that part I'm really not sure. I would believe that it depends on what the sales tax is in that particular the other state. But as it relates to Michigan, and say, for example, you're at an event where you're selling books and yet you're actually charging sales tax for the purchase of the book, then the sales tax that is due to the state of Michigan is based on the Michigan sales tax laws. And at this time, the sales tax for the state of Michigan is at 6%. So what you're collecting in terms of the sales tax that you're for the purchase of the book is what then you'll be responsible for sending to the state of Michigan for sales tax collection.
Okay, and I assume that would be the same case in whatever state you're in. It would just be whatever the sales tax in the state is that you would add on to the book.
Yes. I believe that's how it works for, like, for example, the example that you use of it being California. So, right, so it would just be the sales tax that would be associated with that particular wherever it's being shipped to. I'm more familiar with it as it relates to the state of Michigan, so since we're in Michigan. But it's important to, if you're selling to out of state, to be familiar with what the sales tax regulations are for that particular state so that you're in compliance with those as well.
Definitely. There's usually, I found, a temporary sales tax license you can get for like an event that's going to be a week or less. And the paperwork really isn't that bad, although it differs from state to state. Okay, Edna, it's been a real treat having you on, and I want to thank you on behalf of myself and Tyler and Irene, who will be very sad that she missed you. And we'd like to give our listeners your website address or your email address or whatever way you'd like them to contact you.
Well, they can contact me at my email address. That would be, well, actually, I'll give you both. The email address is Washington Consult. It's WASHINGTONCONSULT at ATT.net. Washington Consult at ATT.net. And, well, the website is actually where I'm in a little further development of my website, so that is changing. But it is WashingtonConsultants.BraveHost.com. Again, that's WashingtonConsultants.BraveHost.com. It's being redone, but that's the current one. So there is the basic information regarding services that Washington Consultants provides, but be on the lookout for a new website coming soon.
Okay, great. And I should let our listeners know that you're based in the Detroit area. In case there's any people in Michigan that are interested in getting hold of you, they would be especially advised to give you a call. Okay, you've been listening to another podcast edition of Authors Access, where authors get published and published authors get successful. We'll be back on the air May 21st, 2009, when our topic will be Everything You Wanted to Know About Subsidy Publishing But Were Afraid to Ask. And our special guest will be Pete Masterson. You can learn more about our guest on the Authors Access website, which is authorsaccess.com. Again, we'd love to hear your questions and comments about tonight's show. Please send them to info@authorsaccess.com. Authors Access is a joint production of Reader Views Incorporated and Loving Healing Press.
For Reader Views, this is Tyler Tischler in Marquette, Michigan.
For Loving Healing Press, this is Victor Volkman in Ann Arbor, Michigan, wishing you all a good evening.